Well, he certainly is quite the showman. I'll give him that, this young rabbi out of nowhere. He just blows into town. He starts getting the commoners stirred up, trying to make some kind of name for himself. I'll tell you this, if he's going to do that, he doesn't need to be attracting who he's attracting, these smelly fishermen and tax collectors and prostitutes and sinners. And I hear he's a healer. You know, I've known a lot of healers in my day. And when they come in and they heal you of your money or they heal you of your food or they heal you of whatever it is of yours that they want, then they just move on to the next poor sap who's dumb enough to fall for their bait. What about that hole in the roof? Who's going to fix that? Okay? Did anybody ever think about that? Who's going to fix that hole in the roof? You know, I'll bet Jesus just arranged this whole thing. At least, that's what we'll make sure everybody hears. What did he just say? His sins are forgiven? Oh, of all the arrogant brash, he has crossed a line. That is blasphemy. Only God can forgive sins. Oh, and now he presumes to tell me that he thinks he knows what I'm thinking. I wouldn't tell him even though he is right. What? That guy on the mat. I've seen that guy around. You know, I don't know if it was him or his parents, but somebody sinned. He's the way he is because that's God's justice. God obviously wants him to be like that. Get up and walk. I'd like to see that. He's stirring. He is getting up. Looks like he might be ready to dance. And they're all shouting and they're all applauding. We've never seen anything like this. Praise to God. Indeed. Well, I'll tell you this. I don't know how Jesus did it. I don't know what's going on here, but he's either going to be silent or he will be silenced. You know, when we look at the account in Mark chapter 2 in that first 12 verses of Jesus healing the lame man, there are a lot of different characters at play. Certainly Jesus is there, but also the teachers of the law whose perspective we just looked at a little bit. And there was the lame man and there were his four friends, but you know, there was also another main character in this story. The crowd. If you go through Mark's gospel, the crowd is there. They're a constant presence in Jesus' ministry from the beginning all the way to the end of the book. And that crowd, they get to see things, they get to witness things as they walk with Jesus through his ministry. And wouldn't it have been exciting to have been a part of that crowd? Maybe you could have been one of those people who heard early that Jesus was coming back to town. And so you made it to that little house before everybody else got there and you got inside. But as more and more people came, it started getting more and more crowded. And everybody started pressing in so tight that eventually, not only was it just standing room only, but people were standing at the door trying to peek in. People were at the windows trying to see, trying to hear Jesus. Because just like you, they'd heard about him, but now they're actually going to get to hear him. But you also notice another little group of people in that house, over against the back wall, and they're sitting there, cold, stone-faced, and they're looking at Jesus with this judgmental stare. But these guys, they're not strangers to you. I mean, these are the teachers of the law. These are guys that you've grown up seeing. I mean, these are the guys who pat little boys on the head as they're coming into synagogue on the Sabbath day. And they smile and they give a piece of candy to a little girl who's running off to play with her friends. These are men who have taught you about this exact same God that Jesus is now talking about. But there's something different. There's something different in the way Jesus talks about God. Because His words are filled with so much joy and hope and life. It's not all about checking off the right box or being exactly in the right way, but it's about life. And you can hear in His words an authority that these teachers of the law have never carried when He talks about God. And as you're listening to Jesus talk, well, then that's when it happens. Now, at first, it's just a little bit of a distraction, a little bit of noise. But then it gets louder and more consistent. You see maybe a little bit of debris fall on Jesus' head. And He steps back, and as you look up to the roof, He looks up to the roof as this little hole starts to grow bigger and bigger and bigger until sunlight just streams through it. And then that sunlight is blocked by the silhouette of a man being lowered down on a mat right at Jesus' feet. And when Jesus sees this, He lets out a laugh, not a ridiculing laugh, but a laugh of joy. And He commends those four men peering down through the hole of their faith in bringing their friend to Him. And then Jesus gives that man the greatest gift of all. He tells him, "Your sins are forgiven." But that's when it happens. That's when the tension really, really begins to rise. Because Jesus turns His attention toward those men in the back of the room, those cold, stone-faced men. And that's where the conflict begins. You see, the teachers of the law, they had already marked Jesus as the enemy, in spite of the good things He was doing, in spite of what the crowd was seeing and the amazement that they had. And throughout this section of Mark's gospel, this first part of it, we see the teachers of the law and the Pharisees move from this idea of we've got to control Jesus to, no, we just need to eliminate Jesus. But why? Why were they so scared? Well, we know that one thing that they didn't like was the fact that Jesus' popularity was rising. People were coming to Him. People were listening to Him. People were hearing things that they weren't saying. And so they were jealous. Without a doubt, they were jealous. But there was something more. You see, Jesus had an inclusiveness that was foreign to the teachers of the law. The sick, the poor, the unclean, tax collectors, prostitutes, other sinners, people who would normally be rejected or marginalized or told that they didn't matter, those were the people Jesus loved. Those were the people that He had brought to Him. Those were the people He went to. You see, Jesus is facing off against worldly powers cloaked as religious authority. So in this early confrontation, we stand in the crowd and we see Jesus and these religious authorities start to square off against each other. Now, I don't know if you remember what it was like when a fight happened back when you were in high school? But I do. You know, it would be like a normal day in high school, and you're going down this crowded hallway, and there's almost so many people that you wonder if you're even going to be able to maneuver across the hallway to get to your locker. But then it happens. Somebody here shouts out something to somebody across the hall, whether it's calling them a name or saying something about their mama or about their sister. Well, as soon as they say that, you guys remember how it went? Everybody just kind of backed up and made this circle of humanity around these two people who are in the middle. And you could just, you could feel the tension, wondering what was about to happen. Now, I don't know if in that little house, if they pressed back even more and left Jesus and the teachers of the law in the center. But you could definitely feel that tension rising. And as that tension started to rise, thoughts started probably going through their mind. At first, very surface kind of things like, well, I wonder if somebody's going to throw a punch. Who do you think would win that? I mean, I'd bet on Jesus. He's younger, probably faster. Yeah, but there's six of them. Yeah, but I've never known Jesus to be violent. Have you? But after all those questions kind of evaporate, then begin the deeper questions. What did he really mean when he said that man was forgiven? I mean, that sounds pretty good to me. The way my life has gone, the choices I've made lately, forgiveness sounds good. How can he have such an essence of peace with all this animosity that's being directed at him? You know, he speaks and acts with such authority, but if the teachers of the law are right, he's equating himself with God. Am I really ready to go there? And there's something so different about him. Could he actually be the one, the Messiah that we've been looking for? And then Jesus does the unexpected. You know, anyone can say your sins are forgiven, blasphemy or not. Anyone can say that. That's easy. But Jesus proves he has the authority to do that, to forgive the man's sins by not just bringing spiritual wholeness to him, but also by bringing physical wholeness to him. This is a great story. I love this passage in Mark's gospel. But the question is, what does this have to do with me? What is the significance of this bit of scripture for someone in 21st century America? Well, I would tell you that this speaks to us because we are in the exact same place as that crowd. We are participants in this story. You see, we're still a part of this crowd. And we're still looking at Jesus. And we're still having to make the decision every single step of the way. How am I going to engage Jesus? There's two very distinct ways to do that are presented in this story. Now, the first one is the way the teachers of the law engaged Jesus. And their way of engaging Jesus was to say we either must control him or we must eliminate him. Those are our choices. Now, when we look at that side, it's easy for us sitting in a church building to say, well, that's not me. I would never try to control Jesus. But the reality is, so many times we really do. When I don't let Jesus be the Lord of my life, and I mean truly be the Lord of my life, when I don't let him reign in my heart, when I don't take his word seriously, when I act as if I think that I know better than him, then I'm trying to take that control. Anytime that I think to myself, you know, I'm okay to have this much Jesus in my life, But anything beyond that, I don't really need it. And so we hear Jesus say things like, do not worry. Oh, but Jesus, see, you just don't understand. You don't understand how busy my life is. You don't understand the pressures that are on me. You don't understand that everybody's trying to get a little piece of me. And so what I need you to do, Jesus, is just let me have that much control back, okay? I'll take care of the things I'm worried about. Or we hear Jesus say, love your enemy and pray for those who persecute you. Oh, but Jesus, you don't know what it's like to have put up with someone like him for all these years that I have. I mean, he is a mean, cruel person. He's all the time talking about me, lying about me, trying to do things to hurt me. I can't love somebody like that, Jesus. So just let me have that control back, okay? Or we hear that Jesus says, care for the poor. Well, come on, Lord. You know those people. They're just deadbeats. They're lazy. Okay? They could get a job if they want to. And I can just group them all into one big clump, and I don't have to know anything about them individually or their individual stories. Just give me that control back that I can do what I want with that. Jesus says, love your neighbor. But God, all my neighbor does is sit on his front porch and drink beer all day. How am I supposed to love him? I mean, yeah, I suppose I could go over there and I could talk to him and I could find out something about him or his life or his family. But I don't want my kids around that influence. I don't want that around me. And so what I'm going to do, I'm just going to wave at him from a safe distance as I drive by. On and on we could go. We know what Jesus says. We know what Jesus teaches. We know what it would take to really allow Jesus to be the Lord of our lives. Whether it's my marriage, my free time activities, my relationships, what I teach my children, how I treat others, the words that I choose to use, the things that I allow to come into my home through TV or computer or media, whatever. How I spend my money, every aspect of my life, I choose whether I submit to Jesus as Lord or not. But isn't it always easier to rationalize and to justify and to ignore and to say, Jesus, why don't you just let me keep control of that? And if that doesn't work, then we can just eliminate him. Now, I'm not just talking about atheists here, although they would fit that category. But a lot of times, folks who still come to church are working on eliminating Jesus. You see, they still talk the Christian lingo. They still have all the answers. They know God's will. And after all, God owes them heaven because they've done all the right things. But for all practical purposes, just like those teachers of the law, they've eliminated Christ from their life. They've so compartmentalized him that Jesus is just this Sunday, Wednesday thing that I do. And all the rest of the week, well, that's mine for whatever I want to do. As long as I, you know, check the boxes, everything else is okay. And we eliminate Jesus. But there's another way that this crowd can come to Jesus too. And the way that this other crowd, or the other way that this crowd comes to Jesus is like the lame man and his four friends. They come to Jesus in simple faith. They come to Jesus in their brokenness. They come to Jesus with no illusions of being in control, no thoughts of manipulating the situation for their benefit, no delusions that he somehow owes them anything or that they deserve anything, but still knowing fully that he, that Jesus, and only he can heal our wounded spirits and our broken lives and make us whole again. Do we come to Jesus like that lame man, boldly claiming the promises that God has given us through his Son? the promise of peace, which isn't a promise that we'll never have conflict, and the promise of joy, which isn't necessarily a promise that we're always going to be happy. And most importantly, the promise of an abundant life, which I can promise you, the abundant life Jesus gives us looks radically different from what the world tells us makes for an abundant life. When we come as the lame man, we come just as I am, in my brokenness, in my sinfulness, in my need, knowing that we need God's love and His grace and His mercy and His forgiveness. Now, we have one great advantage over that crowd that we read about in Mark's gospel. And the advantage that we have is that we can look at this in hindsight and we know how the story ends. You see, that conflict between Jesus and the teachers of the law, it continues to escalate until it comes to the point that they have Jesus nailed to a cross and sealed in a tomb. And they think they've won. But then God delivers the final knockout punch. And Jesus is resurrected. Death can't hold him. And now all those things that the teachers of the law represented, that self-aggrandizing, the jealousy, the prejudice, the pride, the hatred, the divisions, all that's done away with. And Jesus shows us a way of acceptance and kindness, humility, love, life, and hope. This morning, you're standing in the crowd. In every moment of your life, you're standing in the crowd. And there's Jesus in the middle. And you get to make the choice. You get to make the choice in your everyday, ordinary life, in your predictable, common, daily, normal, regular, ordinary moments. You get to make the choice. What am I going to do with Jesus? How am I going to come to Him? Am I going to come to Him trying to stay in control and trying to make things happen the way that I want them to happen? Or am I going to come to Him in that simple faith, trusting and knowing? And the question is, which will you choose? We have the blessing of having a wonderful church family that gets to help us in making those choices and helping to lead us in the direction that Jesus is calling us. And if we can help in any way this morning as you're making that choice, would you come as we stand and sing this invitation song?